From WNYC New York Public Radio, I'm Leonard Lopate. This is just one segment of the Leonard Lopate Show, but every interview is available on demand at WNYC.org. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC On Demand is supported by Open from American Express, presenting the interactive webcast event, Making a Name for Yourself. Kate and Andy Spade and Bobby Brown discuss their leap from business to brand. Created by Open from American Express. Registration at openforumonline.com. You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
On the morning of September 11, 2001, New Yorker staff writer Lawrence Wright asked David Remnick to put him to work. And as a result, he's become the magazine's expert on Al-Qaeda. And now his tireless research and hundreds of interviews have resulted in a new book, which is already a bestseller, called The Looming Tower, Al-Qaeda and the Road to 9/11. In it, he follows in detail the lives of people on both sides of the story, the radical Islamic movement, and the U.S. intelligence community. The book is published by Knopf, and I'm very pleased that it has brought Lawrence right back to my show today. Hi.
It's good to see you again.
In focusing on the individuals behind Al-Qaeda with such detail, were you concerned that you might humanize them to the point of making them somewhat sympathetic?
Well, it wasn't a concern of mine. I wanted to understand them. It was my hope that I could at least penetrate, you know, their backgrounds and get a sense of why they thought what they thought and what led them to make the decisions that they did. I understand that, you know, some people may not be ready to see them as real personalities, three-dimensional with, you know, good and bad sides. I don't think I ever am forgiving of what they've done, but I do try to be understanding of who they are and where they came from.
And so people are all startled when they discover that Osama bin Laden used to watch Bonanza when he was a kid.
Yeah, and Fury. Those were his two big shows.
Did similar things spark the extremism for Osama bin Laden and Ayman al-Zawahiri?
Yeah, well, and they were different in each case, you know.
Because they come from such different backgrounds. Different,
absolutely. Zawahiri is, you know, a medical doctor, and he really came out of a long tradition of radicalism in Egypt. Said Qutb, who's the man that I begin this book with, was an Islamist philosopher and educator who came to America in 1948 and wrote this book called Milestones, Ma'alam fil Tariq, which is the book that all of them read. They have that in common. And then Zawahiri, when Nasser hanged Sayyid Qutb in 1966, Zawahiri started a cell to overthrow the Egyptian government when he was 15 years old. Now that's who we're dealing with from that side. And then bin Laden, he was a, you know, much more of an idealist. He was rich. He came from a very, very prominent family. Zawahiri was rounded up and tortured after the Sadat assassination in prison, you know, had a brutal experience in prison, and came out, you know, lusting for blood. He met bin Laden during the jihad against the Soviets, and that Al-Qaeda really is a creation of the two of them.
Now, I remember a New Yorker cartoon after 9/11 in which these people are in a penthouse cocktail party, and one man is saying to another, I feel that if these Al-Qaeda people could come to a party like this, they wouldn't hate us so much. And it seems it's just the opposite. Somebody like Qutb came to America and was shocked by what he found here.
Right. You know, it's a template for so many radical Muslims that discovered themselves as extremists in the West. When he came here, America, just after the war, 1948, you know, America's standing in the world, and especially in the Arab and Muslim world, had never been higher. And yet he saw a different America than the one that Americans thought of, you know, of who we are. For one thing, he was a very dark Egyptian, and so he saw the racist side of America. He spent a good deal of time in a little education college in Greeley, Colorado, and you couldn't imagine if you were to pick a place in America that would be, you would think, the most congenial spot for this teetotaling, middle-aged Egyptian virgin. It was, you know, there were no bars in Greeley. It was a temperance colony. There was a church on every corner. You would think this would be perfect for him.
So he was. It wasn't the kind of secularism that so many other jihadists have complained about that shocked him, or was even that modest town just too secular for him?
It was not the secular nature of it. What scandalized him about the religion in Greeley was the mix of sexuality and religion. There's a famous scene that he writes about a church dance. And the priest had put on Baby, It's Cold Outside, which was a brand new song then. And, of course, the lyrics are extremely suggestive, and Qutb listened very carefully to them. And he was scandalized by the fact that the minister turned the lights down low so that it would create a more romantic atmosphere for these teenagers.
Why was he hanged for treason? What had he done to... In 1966, so that was Sadat.
It was Nasser.
It was still Nasser. Huh?
Yeah, and you know Nasser led the revolution in Egypt in 1952, and he enlisted Qutb, who was a member of the Muslim Brotherhood, you know, to try to create this new country. In retrospect, it's hard to understand what they had in common. Nasser wanted to create a socialist state, a pan-Arab. It was a secular state that he had in mind. Qutb had this extremely opposite idea that it was going to be an Islamic theocracy. Arab, non-Arab didn't matter to him. It's Islam that was the thing. Socialism, he was indifferent to socialism. That, you know, the Quran talks about let there be class upon class. You know, Quran doesn't really speak about those issues. So their vision was so at odds.
As different as... Osama bin Laden's is with Saddam Hussein's.
Yes, exactly.
As we've just learned from some recent CIA documents.
Yes, you know, this schism, these two visions persist to today. You know, the Arab world is so riven by these alternative ideas about what kind of future they want to have.
So were a lot of people reading Qutb?
Oh, everybody read it. You know, he was one of the most popular writers in the Arab world, and still, even when I was living in Saudi Arabia during the course of writing and researching this book, every Friday they would excerpt some of Sayyid Qutb's writings. He's still very, very current.
Now, why is there this feeling about modernity throughout the Muslim world? The Muslims used to be the most modern. During the Middle Ages in Europe, the Muslims were the people who were doing all the advanced math and writing all the important books and doing the cutting-edge medicine.
You know, modernity is a broad word. You know, even bin Laden is not opposed, for instance, to using bulldozers and caterpillars
and cell phones.
And cell phones, all those things. And Qutb wrote about this. It was his vision that there is no such thing as real Islam anymore. Islam, the pure Islam, died in the 7th century after the Prophet and his immediate successors died. And his vision is to take their society back to that 7th century when the Islam was a completely, in his mind, you know, total entity, controlling everything about people's lives, the state, their own behavior, all a radical, completely thoroughgoing society. That would be the state that they would want to go back to. And in the minds of many of the Islamists, such as bin Laden, the only expression of that in modern times was the Taliban.
My guess is Lawrence Wright. His book, The Looming Tower, Al-Qaeda. I'm never sure whether to say Al-Qaeda, Al-Qaeda. Any number of experts have come here and pronounced it both ways.
Right.
But I'll say Al-Qaeda because that's what you're saying. Al-Qaeda and the Road to 9/11, published by Knopf. What is takfir and why is it essential in understanding radical Islam?
That's a great question. Most people don't know about it and don't think about it, but it's essential to understanding, you know, how bloody-minded this movement has become. Takfir means excommunication. And really, the notion in modern times has always been a presence in Islam. There have been Muslims fighting Muslims forever. But when Sayyid Qutb was in that prison, Nasser put him in prison, and many of the Muslim brothers, after they attempted an assassination on Nasser's life, there was a group of Muslim brothers who were in a cell, and the guards opened up the door and began to shoot them down. They killed 27 of them. Many others were wounded, just pinned in the cell with no way of defending themselves. Qutb, who had frail health, was in the prison hospital, and they brought in the wounded, and he asked himself, what kind of Muslim would do this to another Muslim? And his answer, which resonates through modern times, is they're not Muslims. They are something else. And there he began his really radical notion of saying there are some people who say they're Muslims who are not. Only people who are like us are Muslims. That's the core of Al-Qaeda's war against other Muslims, which is really, you know, in many ways, since 9/11, more victims of Al-Qaeda are Muslims than anybody else.
So how do they determine who's a real Muslim and who isn't?
Really, the circle's very small. It's just them.
And then there was the attack on the Grand Mosque in Mecca in 1979, an attack by Muslims on Muslims.
Yeah, and that was a signal moment as well. 1979 is really the year that shook Islam, because you had the invasion of Afghanistan, you had the Shah being overthrown, and in a radical Islamic state being established. But what many people don't realize, it almost as great as those two events was the fact that the Grand Mosque in Mecca was overtaken by a group of radical extremists who wanted to bring down the royal family. And for a couple of weeks, they held out against the Saudi armed forces and broadcast their message. Now, it's not true that bin Laden was a part of it, but he was very affected by it, and he later said that those people were pure Muslims.
Mm-hmm. So he was already joining in on this thinking of what is a pure Muslim and what isn't.
Yeah.
Takfir is important to him.
Right.
Do you think that the jihadi movement might not have happened at least the way it has if the Soviets hadn't gone into Afghanistan?
Well, it sure emboldened them because, it was a war by the Afghan people against the Soviet Union. They're the ones that won the war. But there was a small contingent of Arabs, of which bin Laden was a part, no more than 3,000 whoever went there. And very few of them actually got into battle. So they were negligible. They just got in the way. The Afghans actually told them to shut it down for a couple of times. But bin Laden is at least, in one of his qualities, he's a brilliant spin master. And he spun this legend of the Arab Afghans that says that we went to Afghanistan, we confronted the Soviet Union, there we bled it to death, and it left, you know, we chased it out of Afghanistan, and it was destroyed, it fell apart. And that legend is what is at the basis of Al-Qaeda's appeal.
And do they see the Soviet Union and the United States as being all part of the same thing? Because this, you know, during the Cold War,
we were allies, right? Yeah.
In fact, we were supplying Osama bin Laden with military equipment to fight the Soviets.
Actually, we didn't supply bin Laden. We did supply the Afghans. But it's true that we were fighting on the same side. In part, bin Laden's attack on America was strategic. He wanted to overthrow the Saudi royal family. The turning point in his decision was in 1990 when Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait and then massed troops on the Saudi border. Saddam Hussein was not, bin Laden had been speaking out against him and warning of this very eventuality. So he went to the defense minister, Prince Sultan, and offered to use his little organization, Al-Qaeda, to defend the kingdom along with these maybe 100,000 unemployed Saudi youth against what was a million-man Iraqi army with one of the largest tank corps in the world. And the defense minister laughed him out of the office. But the fact that Saudi Arabia then turned to the United States was the line that was crossed with bin Laden. He could never forgive the royal family or the U.S. for occupying what he thought of was the holy ground.
Was he alone in that, or was that also the feeling of the majority of the Saudi people?
Many of them, certainly. There is a religious reason for this. the Prophet Muhammad on his deathbed issued an injunction that there should be no two religions in Arabia. Of course, at the time that he died, there were many Christians and Jews in the Arabian Peninsula. But strict Wahhabis like bin Laden believe that the entire Arabian Peninsula should be purged of any non-Muslims.
So what role does humiliation play in this radical way of thinking? Was there a sense of humiliation there?
You know, there are different kinds of humiliation. It's one of the most common words in bin Laden's vocabulary. Zawahiri was humiliated in prison by the torture. It was horrible. He was personally humiliated, and it affected him. I think that accounts for his lust for blood. Bin Laden was rich and celebrated. You know, he was one of the best families in the entire kingdom. He had never experienced personal humiliation, but he certainly spoke to the sense of cultural humiliation that so many Muslims feel. I think, you know, we can really kind of date it in an ironic way to September 11th, 1683, mm-hmm. which is the date that the King of Poland arrived at the gates of Vienna to relieve the Ottoman siege. And that was the moment, the furthest advance of the Muslim armies in Europe. And it marks the moment when Islam began its steady retreat.
Is that just a coincidence, September 11th?
It's an odd date. It wouldn't be the same, you know, on the Muslim calendar. So I don't think that bin Laden looked at it as an anniversary.
My guest is Lawrence Wright, who is a staff writer for The New Yorker and a fellow at the Center on Law and Security at New York University School of Law, the author of 5 works of nonfiction, City Children, Country Summer, In the New World, Saints and Sinners, Remembering Satan, Twins, and now The Sixth, The Looming Tower, Al-Qaeda and the Road to 9/11, which is published by Knopf. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Lawrence Wright of The New Yorker. His new book, The Looming Tower, Al-Qaeda and the Road to 9/11, is published by Knopf. Got an amazing review in the New York Times Book Review, front page. Mm-hmm. But you spent 2 years teaching at the American University in Cairo.
Right.
Were you aware of any of the sentiments that you later had to focus on when you were writing this book?
Well, you know, that was a long time ago, and it was 69 to 71. It was a completely different era. It was a religious society. It was a conservative society, but you never saw women in hijabs in the university, for instance. You would see women in black out in the villages. You would never see, you know, the prayer mark, except on Sadat's head. He was, you know, at that time, that little dark bruise that was on the top of his forehead. A lot of Egyptians were kind of embarrassed about this kind of overt display of piety. And the Muslim Brotherhood, however, I was aware of because one of my professors had his brother in prison. And I was there when when Nasser died and Sadat came to power and let the Muslim Brothers out. So I knew about the radicals that were coming back into society.
So the big change over the, 30 years or so, has been that Arab nationalism has largely been replaced by Islamism, I guess is the word, and thoughts about jihad. Nobody talked about jihad in those days, did they?
No. It's been a sad journey politically for a lot of Arab countries because they've tried, you know, socialism, Marxism. They've opened up their economies. They've tried Arab nationalism, and everything that they've attempted has not been successful. In part because, you know, they have extremely restrictive governments, and also they're such unproductive societies. This is one of the things that is at the root, I think, of Al-Qaeda, the appeal of radicalism for a lot of young Muslims and especially Arabs, is that there's no way for them to be powerful in the world. Their lives are so futile and unexpressed, and you can't help but be aware when you're in that part of the world how depressed many young people are.
But even within the Islamic movement, there are big differences. There's Sheikh Abdullah Azzam, for example,
right,
who was allied with Osama and then they split.
Yeah, well, he got offed, is what happened. they were partners in bringing Arabs to Afghanistan. Sheikh Abdullah Azzam issued the fatwa that called up young Arabs to come fight against the Soviet invader, and bin Laden offered to pay for them. And that induced, a rather small number of Arabs to actually go to Afghanistan to fight. And Azzam was the leader of the Arab Afghans, but really bin Laden and the Saudis pushed him aside. The Saudis were uncomfortable having a member of the Muslim Brotherhood and a Palestinian be in charge of young Saudi men, so they wanted one of their own.
Well, how did they allow Zawahiri to be part of the leadership then? He's another Egyptian.
Yes. You know, the interesting thing about Zawahiri and bin Laden, they were both together, you know, in Peshawar, Pakistan, on the edge of the Khyber Pass. Zawahiri was not interested in the Afghan jihad. He was only there to capture young Egyptians so he could train them to take them back and fight in Egypt. But he spotted bin Laden, and I'm sure, you know, Zawahiri, chronically short of money, saw this wealthy and charismatic young Saudi, and who had a vision, really. Bin Laden had an idea, which was that he was going to create an all-Arab foreign legion. It was really an anti-communist organization. He wanted to chase the Soviets out of Afghanistan and then pursue them in Central Asia and fight them in Yemen. And bin Laden didn't share that dream. But he did want access to bin Laden and his money, so he had the personnel. He had the, you know, he had police officers, army officers, engineers. He's a doctor himself, so he surrounded bin Laden with his Egyptians and really kind of captured him.
Didn't bin Laden also have some medical problems?
Yeah, that's another thing, that another aspect of bin Laden's dependency on Zawahiri. You know, we heard that bin Laden had kidney disease, and I found no evidence of that. But he is sick. And if you look at the illness, you know, the symptoms of his illness, he would often get faint before battle, and he have chronic back pain, such that he'd be crippled up in the cave and unable to move. He had low blood pressure, really low, and he had a bag of salt with him to help that. And he was addicted to, he was always dipping his finger in the salt. All of these symptoms are what you might find in a person who suffers from Addison's disease, which is the same affliction that John F. Kennedy had, and is treatable with glucose and saline solutions and cortisone shots. But it's also fatal if you are in an Addisonian crisis and you don't have a doctor at your side. So I think that's one reason these two men were bound together.
Now, why do you think there were all of those stories about Osama bin Laden being 6 foot six or 6 foot seven and being on kidney dialysis?
Well,
who does that satisfy?
Well, part of it was myth-making. You know, the CIA, I asked Michael Scheuer, who was head of the bin Laden station at the CIA, where did that physical giant thing come from? Because most of the people I talk to that know bin Laden well say that he's around 6 or 6'1". And he said that he got it from Assam Daraz, who was bin Laden's first biographer, an Egyptian, who was really a hagiographer. You know, he wrote this, glowing picture of bin Laden, and he cast him as being maybe 6'8".
Mm-hmm. And a giant.
A giant, yes. And you know, also it parallels the exaggeration about his wealth, you know, that the CIA thought he was a billionaire, and he was never worth more than $7 million.
My guest is Lawrence Wright. His latest book, The Looming Tower, Al-Qaeda and the Road to 9/11, published by Knopf. This is WNYC 93.9 AM 820. We're online at wnyc.org. He was only worth $7 million or so, that's a nice piece of change. But he structured Al-Qaeda like a corporation, didn't he? He would actually give people vacations and pay for their medical leave and the
health
like.
Benefits.
Did people join because they supported the cause or because it was a well-paying job?
Both of those things are true. For some people, it was just a really good job opportunity, especially these guys that were in Afghanistan who had been in the jihad and weren't welcome in their home countries.
Now, why did Al-Qaeda start using suicide bombers? They used one to kill Massoud, who, yeah. by the way, had been allied with the Sheikh Azam. So right. that was another thing. Yeah. But anyway, suicide bombing was developed by Shiite Muslims, and right. it came out of their notions of martyrdom. But the Sunnis had always rejected it. When did this change, and how did it then wind up leading to lots of people being willing to kill themselves?
Right. There are two streams to this, Leonard. First of all, Hezbollah and Al-Qaeda got together when Al-Qaeda was in Sudan in the years 1992 to 96. And they trained some of the Al-Qaeda fighters. So I think that they were infected by the suicide virus. And Zawahiri is the first to have employed it in 1993. He sent a suicide bomber to attempt to kill the prime minister of Egypt. And he actually innovated the use of the martyrdom tape in that operation. And then in 1995, Zawahiri again, using his own terrorist organization, Al-Jihad, bombed the Egyptian embassy in Islamabad using suicide bombers. And a lot of people, even in his own movement, were very upset by this, that innocents were killed and that deliberate use of suicide. It's very, very opposed. The Quran says, do not kill yourselves. It couldn't be clearer. And there's many sayings of the Prophet where the Prophet goes on and on about, the punishments of hell. If you kill yourself, you will spend all eternity killing yourself in exactly the same manner. So it was quite a philosophical hurdle for Zawahiri to leap over.
This book often reads like a novel. You're right there with bin Laden and his followers as he's watching the planes hit the World Trade Center on television. But you also have a really improbable hero of a sort in John O'Neill.
Oh, yeah. He's a fascinating man.
He sounds like somebody a spy novelist would have invented.
Yeah, no.
And his ending is the sort of thing that we really associate with fiction.
John was the head of our counterterrorism effort here in New York. And he was really a prophet in many ways, because as early as 1996, he was saying that bin Laden and Al-Qaeda formed a real threat to America. And in 1997, he was saying they may be here. Even though the director of the FBI, Louis Freeh, for years after that, was reassuring the White House that Al-Qaeda posed no threat to the homeland. O'Neill was a problematic guy. People loved him or hated him. And a lot of the people who hated him were his bosses. And one of them leaked a story to the New York Times about O'Neill having taken classified information out of the headquarters. And it torpedoed his career. And so he took a job as the head of security at the World Trade Center and died on that day.
And he had warned of an attack of that sort.
He did. And, people say, how ironic that our chief bin Laden hunter didn't get bin Laden. Bin Laden got him. But I don't think that it was ironic. I don't think O'Neill would see it that way. He would tell people when they say, John, they already hit, the Trade Center, so they're not going to hit it again. He said, no, they'll finish the job. So in a way, he instinctively put himself at ground zero.
Many people have argued over whether the CIA was worse at pursuing this story, this case, or the FBI was. What's your feeling? Because John O'Neill was an FBI man, and yet yeah. the FBI in some ways seems to have been a bit more logical in the way it approached it.
Here's the thing. If these two agencies had been able to work together, I think 9/11 would have been stopped. And the unforgivable story, I think, is how John O'Neill, who appointed this 29-year-old Arab-American, Ali Soufan, to be the case agent on the USS Cole bombing.
One of the few people who could speak Arabic.
The only one in New York City, and one of six FBI agents in the whole country. And had the right skills to pursue this, and they developed leads in the Cole bombing in October of 2000 that led to certain Al-Qaeda personalities and to a meeting that had taken place in Malaysia. Three times they queried the CIA about those personalities and that meeting. And three times the CIA refused to help them. Now, let's just take aside the tragedy of 9/11. They were, they were investigating the deaths of 17 American sailors, and in effect, the CIA was obstructing justice. But as it happened, they knew about this meeting in Malaysia. They had asked the Malaysian authorities to surveil it. They had photographs, and they knew that two members of Al-Qaeda flew from Kuala Lumpur to Los Angeles in January of 2000, 20 months before 9/11, and they didn't tell the FBI. Now, that's the failure to communicate that I just think we can't get around.
In this week's New Yorker, you discuss the future of Al-Qaeda, according to radical Islamist thinkers. So what's happened? Has Al-Qaeda been hurt a lot by our campaign against them, the war on terror, or is Al-Qaeda going to do better and better as a result of what's happened?
Leonard, if you read their ideologues and their strategists, as I've been doing, they say that after 9/11, after November, December 2001, when the Battle of Tora Bora took place, they were essentially dead. The leaders got away, but 80 to 85% of the membership, according to the Al-Qaeda writers, was eliminated. Now, that's, they were scattered, unable to communicate with each other. They were repudiated all over the world. So they were, the movement had not been entirely stamped out, but it was essentially destroyed. And then the invasion of Iraq came along and gave new life to this movement. It's a tragedy that, we had all of Al-Qaeda localized in one place in December of 2001, and we didn't finish the job. And unfortunately, that has metastasized now. Their Al-Qaeda proper, the mothership, has certainly been reduced. But what's so scary when you read these ideologues is they anticipated that. As early as 1998, they were writing about how, the old Al-Qaeda would eventually be eliminated, that, the leadership would be taken away. And so they planned for the day when they would create these spontaneous new groups that would feed on the propaganda and the strategy that Al-Qaeda's put out. And there would be actual struggles for territory, as we see again in Afghanistan and also in Iraq.
So it doesn't matter whether Osama bin Laden is directing operations. Somebody from Morocco can be doing it, or somebody in Egypt or anywhere else, and it would all be in the same spirit of Al-Qaeda.
It does matter in a way, because bin Laden is, the unquestioned authority. And, this is a movement that is very fractured. As long as bin Laden and Zawahiri, to some extent, are there issuing directives and inspiring young jihadis, it'll be a problem, but it'll outlive him. There's no doubt about that.
Well, for example, Zarqawi seemed to be a runaway, a renegade, yeah. And yet they were not sure whether they want to accept him as somebody who represented Al-Qaeda. In the end, they did.
Yes.
My guest has been Lawrence Wright. His book, The Looming Tower, Al-Qaeda and the Road to 9/11, is published by Knopf. Thank you so much for being with us.
It's been a great pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Leonard Lopate Show from WNYC, New York Public Radio. You can hear everything we do and check out our other programs on demand at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.